It's FAQ NYC Off-Cycle, where the New Yorkers podcast steps back to take different and deeper looks into some of the things that are always happening, here in the only place in the world. I'm Harry Siegel, and right now you're going to be hearing me and Alex Brooklyn, the pod's original executive producer, in conversation with her friend, Lucy Sun, the author of the brilliant new memoir of transition, I Heard Her Call My Name, which mines the author's earlier life playing, I'd say, a fundamentally masculine role in an incandescent and evanescent New York City in light of that transition. Lucy is, of course, the author of many previous books, including the classic Low Life, Lures and Snares of Old New York, The Other Paris, an illustrated journey through a city's poor and bohemian past, and an earlier memoir, a masterpiece of evasion, with a title that's relevant and resonant now, I think, The Factory of Facts. Let's jump right in. Good morning, Alex and Lucy.
Good morning.
Good morning, or afternoon for me, as I'm currently in Paris. Lucy, how are you doing today?
I'm good. You're in Paris. Holy cow.
I am. So I want to delve into this book because there's so much to delve into. It's a memoir centering primarily on your transition from male to female at 67 years old during COVID. Your egg cracking, as the saying goes. You talk about your body as a place, as a metaphysical space. You also talk about the place your body is in, like New York City, as a metaphysical space and almost like a backdrop to the production of Luke, as you say in the book, that you mounted for the majority of your life. What really struck me about the book is that it's written, or I read it as written, in three acts. However, those acts are braided. They're not sequential. They're all happening at once. So we get to live with you during this transition as you're having all of these memories. The acts are a childhood in immigration from Europe, a young adulthood in the very frantic 70s and 80s of New York City, the frantic energy of that city in that time, and the East Village art scene. And then externally, a calmer moment in the Hudson Valley as a senior, externally, I say. So why did you decide to kind of map the history of your transition in this way and tie it so closely to the places in which you lived and how you moved through these environments?
Okay, well, I mean, first of all, I had an engineering problem. I had these two stories, one of them being very short, like 6 months, and the other one being 67 years, 68 years by that point. And in what order do I tell them? And I realized it made the most sense to interleave. And that way I could build a suspense mechanism. Because when you interrupt one story with another, that's what happens. Even if you don't make cliffhangers, they sort of become cliffhangers. And you want to read through to the next. And so, you know, hop, skip, and jump. And places of central importance to me in my life, you know, as an immigrant and as an immigrant who went back and forth a few times. And as an immigrant who went back and forth a few times, when there was about a 30-year cultural and technological difference between Europe and the U.S., in Europe, we were living in the 1930s. Nobody had a car. Nobody had a refrigerator. Nobody had television, you know. We were pre-war, essentially. In America, it was the jet age. It was the Kennedy administration. It was all that stuff, you know, the new frontier. And so even now, I'll think of, like, I'll suddenly miss some prospect in suburban New Jersey in 1966. And I want to go there. I literally think about getting into the car and going there for a split second before I realize, no, it's not just in New Jersey. It's also in 1966. I tend to mix those two up. So anyway, place is of cardinal importance to me. It's I'm always going to register where I am and what direction the light is coming from, you know. So this book largely takes place in New York City with some Belgium, some Paris, some San Francisco, and some present-day Hudson Valley, you know. And that's why I wrote a book about the reservoirs, because it's where I live. You know, everybody thinks it's weird that I wrote a book about reservoirs and then a book about transitioning, but they're both very personal, just in slightly different ways.
I like the book about reservoirs. And I heard another interview you were on that where you had said you'd written about everywhere else you had lived except the Hudson Valley. And so this is your, you know,
exactly. Yeah.
You're almost marrying the place in a way. Mm-hmm. All right. So another big theme in the book is your relationship with women, both before and after your transition. You said in the book that you desired or felt that you had and felt more comfortable with the emotional range that women had. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that range kind of comes from these kind of secret, candid moments between women, because of societal rigidity, because of the graphic nature of reproduction and needing to find pockets of intimacy with others, because of the graphic nature of, you know, growing older, menopause, hormones, etc. And some of your descriptions of transition, really, the way you described them, the rhythm of the sentences, really reminded me of the way women describe puberty, menopause, postpartum. I mean, you and I have talked a lot about this, but even women going through assisted fertility treatments like myself, the ways in which hormones intersect with the mind and the spirit, which I have heard you say you didn't even really realize how that played into things until much later.
Yeah.
So as you move through this time, like especially describing like the sweating and the sudden realization that you are seen. And, you know, it was so descriptive of times that I myself have been stricken a mess, or feeling like a mess because of some hormonal shift, because of what my body is doing. And I felt a lot of identification in a lot of those descriptions. And I wondered, you know, one, is that purposeful that some of the descriptions, so many female assigned women would find such identification? And also, as you move through this transition, as you are further and further along, what kind of things are you discovering about your relationship to that society of women, especially now as more and more trans women are like joining, let's say?
Okay, well, I didn't do anything deliberate as far as, you know, I'm amazed to hear that, actually. I just wrote it. I mean, I've never written anything faster than I wrote this book. It just came out in fire hose. And, you know, I mean, the rhythms came of their own accord. I really changed there wasn't much editing. I mostly subtracting. And as far as my relation to trans women and their society, it's weird because, you know, there is like, for example, in Brooklyn, this thriving trans, even trans literary society. I've been to a couple of literary salons. The first one I went to was in summer, and there were like 80 trans women in this apartment with a backyard. And the fact is that I was old enough to be almost everybody's grandmother. So I'm of it, but not of it, you know, or in it, but not of it, or of it, but not in it, or something like that. And I've also developed mostly, you know, well, entirely epistolary relationships with older trans women. You know, and it's really a remarkable range of all kinds of people. You know, I mean, I sometimes wonder if transgender matters complicated by non-binary, which is something I poorly understand. And that may be a generational thing. I wonder if being trans isn't like a fixed percentage of the population. It certainly seems to affect people from every ethnic group, every social class, every layer of society, every possible race, color, and creed. And among those of us who are older, especially the older ones who came out decades ago, the various compromises with society that they've made is just amazing. I've met trans women my age who came out as teenagers and have been stealth ever since. Stealth meaning that it's a secret. Nobody knows they're trans. So you have that hidden population. And that still goes on. There are younger people who do that too. People you'd never guess, seriously. And at the same time, there are people who are like proud of being trans, wouldn't want to be cis, and all the shadings of non-binary. So, I have a couple of competing theories about all this. I here where I live, I know there are trans people in town, but I haven't really connected with anybody up here. I guess it's partly me too, because I tend to actually cherish the fact that I'm sort of anonymous here. I feel more seen in New York, and that's fine. I like just disappearing into the woodwork when I'm at home.
As you say, you have theories that are kind of growing and forming, as I feel a lot of people's theories are growing and forming in the ways in which they're going to interact with each other in an age in which we are trying to defetishize trans people the same way that, there was a defetishization of homosexuals. Mm-hmm. I read this amazing thing a long time ago, I think in the New Yorker, how there was just there was way less of a instance of sex in parks. Like there were arrests were way, way down. And for some reason in the article, they didn't mention the fact that, yeah, it's not a crime to be gay anymore. So gay people don't go to parks anymore to have sex with each other. They just go on a date. Anyway, so part of my question was about how also you were interacting with female assigned women and how that kind of came to you during this transition, wanting to be a part of womanhood, how that's expanded in your circle. And also just like hormone wise, knowing that now more and more menopausal women do hormone replacement therapy, which is estrogen, which is generally the drug given to women who want to transition from male. And I was just wondering what your experience with that has been like, and how your opinions of all the different methods and all the different ways in which you can find camaraderie has formed. And have you met with any sort of resistance from male or female assigned people, cis people?
I really have not met with resistance. I've been kind of amazed by that because I've been bracing for a fight since long before the book was published, and I haven't gotten one. I got one nasty review in this right-wing online publication that was basically the TERF argument. These are men pretending to be women, that kind of thing. And then I went, I did go to my 50th high school reunion, my Jesuit high school on the Upper East Side. And that was very interesting. I mean, I was asked I would never have gone. I didn't even graduate from there. They kicked me out halfway through junior year. But once I became eminent, I became an alumna because they want money from me, which they're never going to get. Some of my gay friends asked that I come. They knew that I was transitioning and they wanted me to make a point. And I'm not the first trans alumna of the school, by the way, but first in my year. And the people who were nice to me 50 plus years ago were nice to me still. And then the others, they weren't nasty to me. They just looked right through me. It was like I wasn't there. I wanted to say hello to one guy, because a lot of those guys were like jocks, et cetera, who I wasn't friends with. But there was one guy I was kind of friends with, and he kept like avoiding me. Like, you know, he would like, I'd be headed in his direction, he'd go to the other side of the room. So that's the most resistance I found. I mean, partly, you know, I suppose because I live in this world of artists and, you know, I taught at Bard, which is, you know, pretty progressive school. So I've been very lucky. And even living up here, and we certainly have a redneck population. I'm always wary of that. But, you know, I pass these people at the supermarket. They don't give me a second look. And that's a lot of it is because I'm old. I'm invisible. I was just saying to somebody that I decided to become a woman at the time, just exactly at the time in life where men and women look more like each other anyway.
So a couple things I'd like to follow up on that you brought up. At one point, you say that you started your transition and your egg cracked right as you reached the shrinking years. Mm-hmm. And then you've got a list of all of these books that allude to transgender themes, mm-hmm. and a Boris Vian essay I've got to find now, or story. I'm not even sure.
Novel. Yeah. It's one of those crime novels. Yeah.
I Boris Vian is a fascinating character for another pod. And you also talk about how this is invariably the work of the young. So I was hoping you could speak a little more about transitioning later in life. And as somebody who had a very firmly assembled, if you will, public character with the sort of masculinity that was expressed largely through your work.
Well, okay, when I say invariably the work of the young, that is the end of a sentence that begins when I was online and I found people being like normal. People who are like trans, but they weren't following some showbiz or porn template. They were just being themselves. Mm-hmm. And those are the young. And, you know, I mean, they're not all like that. You know, there's vast range of trans expression out there, but the people I feel most at home with are the people who act like basically it's no big deal, happy to be this way. You know, it's great. It, for me, see, this feels absolutely normal, and that's maybe the most shocking thing about the whole process is that I kept expecting. Without, you know, if I ever thought about this in the past pre-transition, I think I'm going to be cowering in shame, or I'm going to be like fanatical, not letting myself out of the house until I look perfect. And no, I'm very chill about the whole thing because it just feels like, where has this been all my life? You know, it really, really, really does feel like I should have done this 50 years ago. So I'm most at home with people who aren't performing exactly. I mean, we're all performing all the time. But, you know, I like life to be kind of seamless. I mean, yeah, getting up on stage is one thing, but the whole trans model, which I admire, don't get me wrong. I mean, I used to go see Jackie Curtis when she would bartend at her grandmother's bar on Second Avenue, Slugger Ann's. And Jackie, I saw Holly Woodlawn perform too. I never saw Candy Darling, alas. But what those women were about, well, it was they were a subset of a larger 60s phenomenon, really. Life actors, people who, you know, I just came across the fact that Wavy Gravy is 87 years old. Think of that. I mean, don't even have to be trans to be a life actor, right? All these people in the 60s were putting on a show that was like all the time, and it was hyped up, and usually have to do with drugs, of course, you know. I've always been a naturalist. You know, I like performing, but I also like to live life. No, I don't want to be like performing at the supermarket. I don't want to be performing walking down the street, you know? And that's the thing one of the things I've related to the most with the first trans women I got to know well, who were 40 years my junior and recent graduates of Bard. And because they were young, they'd gone through a process of first declaring themselves non-binary around age 16 or something, and then gradually transitioning, et cetera. And it being such a normal part of their lives that they weren't putting on a show every time they walked down the street, you know? So I related to that very deeply.
So following up on all that, and what you said earlier about the book being a fire hose and it just came out and then it was mostly excision, that really jumped out at me, because you wrote a couple things in the book about two-thirds of the way through. I'm going to read briefly from your book. I was trying to mount a production called Luke, written and directed and produced by and starring me as I wanted to be seen, though I never got the impression anyone actually saw me that way. And then when I did socialize, I was performing, but couldn't always withstand the rigors of the craft. And when that happened, I had to isolate. And then on the next page, transitioning lifted the veil. I no longer felt timid. I didn't give a hoot about being judged. I felt like I owned my body, maybe for the first time. So many things about my new being felt familiar, as if I was remembering them. It appeared the transitioning. So here, you're sort of what you said about the book, you were also saying, I think about yourself. Did not involve piling on additional stuff. Rather, it was a process of removal, dismantling the carapace of maleness that had kept me in its grip for so long. So I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that and about being Lucy and maybe in some sense having to perform Lucy as a public figure, as somebody who's doing a book tour and has written this memoir now.
Yeah, well, I mean, to take the first point first, it happens almost every day that I find myself, if I'm in a room with other people, and I, for a split second, I do a body check. Am I standing, sitting, et cetera, right? But that's vestigial. It's about the male presentation. You know, I was always worried that I would look, you know, femme when I was being a guy. And I always had to make sure that, you know, I remember like the whole thing about how you stand with your hands on your hips. Is it fingers forward or is it thumbs forward? You know, there was all this stuff, which the young don't even know about anymore, but that was codes from the 1950s and beyond. But anyway, so I still have like a ghost of that extreme self-consciousness in me. And then I realized I don't have to do that anymore. I could just be me. So there's so much. I mean, well, estrogen has given me new vistas of anxiety simply by being itself. But in terms of like anxiety about who I am in public and how to perform and all that, you know, I got laughed at all the time when I was a kid. My walk was like an object of comedy. Apparently, I bounced. People did imitations of me in the schoolyard. You know, so I was, and also trying to pass as an American, which was also going on, and two were very much intertwined in my mind, being a guy, being an American. And I wasn't sure I understood either of them. I wasn't sure I really wanted either of them, but I felt that I had to, because that's what life had handed me. But it was a tremendous amount of work. And now, you know, fuck it. I mean, as far as the American shit goes, I've gotten the language down, you know, and what more do I need, really? But as far as, you know, I no longer have to pretend to be a guy. And I find myself really not, I mean, yeah, I will like compose my face to look as beauteous as I can. But in terms of like behavioral, do I worry about how I walk, how I stand, how I sit? Not at all. I just do it. And, you know, nobody's ever said, wow, you're really sitting like a, you know, I've never been much of a man spreader, for example, you know, stuff like that. So wait, what was part two?
I bet if we just keep chatting, we'll circle back to it.
I think for younger people, there is still like very, very much younger, you know, teenagers, especially mm-hmm. because of social media, which can be an incredible community builder, but can also be, I would say a lot of teenagers and young people experience a mutilation of their self through social media and through the pressures that it provides, almost a new set of expectations for how to sit, stand, how to hold mm-hmm. your hands to mm-hmm. represent this, that, or the other yeah. thing, whether it has to do with gender or class. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about this as I came across this horrific video on my TikTok, which was a fully clothed woman who was extremely slender. It's not for me to diagnose whether somebody has an eating disorder or not, but it looked mm-hmm. like it. And her gimmick was to hold up baby clothes that she bought at a baby store, and she would show the tag and say, "This is the tag of a baby dress. See, it says 12 months and I'm going to try it on," and to see if she could fit into the little dress as a shirt and a little underwear that she referred to as panties. And I found like the entire thing so interesting and coded and grotesque and strange. And when you mention about all these things from the 50s that people of my generation and younger don't know about, buttons go on what side, I don't know those things. I wore cufflinks and men's clothes as like a cis hetero woman my whole life. You know, I liked that look. And now there are these new emerging modes of societal kind of behavioral control. And they don't necessarily all have to do with gender, but a lot of them do have to do with sex. Yeah. So it's always a strange new world. But speaking of new codes, you catalog in an amazing way the observation of masculinity throughout your life. And I found that pretty incredible. I mean, I don't want to, you know, blow smoke every question, but a lot of my questions are based around things that were super impactful to me while I was reading the book. And your catalog of masculinity, it starts with a cowardly grandfather that would jump into a ditch without securing the safety of his wife and child when he heard a bomb, to this strange alien-like presence of the silent grandfather sitting around, not discussing anything emotional, not discussing anything that they would have shame about, but clearly
same grandfather. Yeah.
Right. But clearly they all were holding some kind of strange mm-hmm. shame. They would just sit in the dark, yeah. not talking. We visit the masculinity of your father, who was a working class laborer who didn't teach you that manual labor because he wanted you to move up to a managerial class of some sort. And then we have it culminated in this absurd character of your college roommate, Brian, who's, you know, the mustache wearing wannabe Hemingway like guy who's cosplaying guy. And then you talk about Jim and George and the East Village art scene. And you talk about the kind of punk scene, which allowed for you to visit gay bars and you to visit the fringe of society, and masculinity could have small quirks. Did you feel like you could hide better there? Did you feel more comfortable in that scene when you found it? So because less people would like catch on? Was that ever even a thought?
No, not really. I mean, I had a lot of gay friends, and in particular, my friend Daryl was kind of crusading. He was part of his mission in those years was to make his straight friends aware of gay world. And so I wasn't the only friend who took around to bars and discos and stuff. But I certainly went to a lot of these, but I also had, you know, I had lots of gay friends like at Strand, their social, individually, these people, some were among my closest friends. Their social world, though, was not one in which I felt myself at home at all. I was still cishet, you know, and the fact is the absence of women, you know. I mean, you did see a few women. You know, I never went to like the mine shaft, right? But so there
what
were places.
What was the mine
shaft? Oh, it was one of these like you know, fist fucking kind of establishments in the a cellar on the west side. There are a lot of those kind of places, and women were generally discouraged there. But I, you know, to be honest, like the funny thing is that there's this gay world and this cishet world of, for example, the jocks in my high school were really kind of similar in being environments in which women were not invited, and who might be discussed all the time, depending on who the players were, but they might just be talking about women and not usually in nice ways on either side. But yeah, these homosocial worlds in which I just felt like complete outsider there. But, you know, but gay culture in New York City in the 70s was just 100 flowers blooming. And there was every kind of representation. And there were people and places that I felt a lot more at home in the theater of the ridiculous than I did in a leather bar, you know. So gay culture before AIDS was its own city within a city. And I forget what else we were addressing here. I tend to go off on these riffs and then...
Just your observations of like masculinity from your grandfather up until the punk era?
Well, I never knew my father's father, who was born in 1879. Think about it. He died before I was born. But my other grandfather, the same one who was the coward and the same one who would sit in the dark. And recently I've been wondering, did he abuse my mother? I mean, I thought, well, it sounds like voguish reaction to everything, but it's actually not beyond the pale. I really wonder about that. Anyway, we'll never know, so who cares? But there was this kind of scary older country guy. And I think, you know, I'm not very happy in the country, generally, me. And I think it has to do with that in a way. My father, on the other hand, was a really good model of masculinity, I think, at least as far as it affected me, because he never pushed me in any direction. And he wouldn't want me to be in a managerial role. He wanted me to be in an intellectual role, actually. Mm-hmm. That's what he wanted for me. He was a great reader, although his reading was scattershot. He was an autodidact. But he had a sense of, like, the music of language and stuff. So I got a lot of very important things from my dad.
You talk about the difficult relationship you have with your mother throughout your life. And one of your chapter markers begins with, like, I was the child that lived. And you talk about how she had a miscarriage and then a stillbirth. And I wondered if your sympathy for her, for that kind of like bodily grief, mm-hmm. became any more informed during your transition, especially with you taking hormones and shifting your own body and all of the strangeness that came with. Did you have a different opinion? Or not a different opinion, but a shift in sympathy or anger for her once you yourself realized your womanhood?
That's a tough one. Because, I mean, this is something, well, even before transitioning, I kept thinking, you know, is it going to happen one day that I can close my account with my mother? Because I was so angry for most of my life. She really did so much to harm me. And I thought, I really thought that, you know, once I start transitioning, estrogen will let me see something. And, you know, I mean, of course I'm sympathetic. She suffered. There's no question about it. I feel terrible for her. She had a rotten life. To what extent that was self-inflicted is another matter.
Mm.
But in any case, I still am unable to say, you know, well, she was okay. I can't, you know, she really, really harmed me in a lot of ways. And the fact that our relationship ended on her cursing me out for trying to figure out a way to tell her that I couldn't bring my baby down to see her on the day after 9/11, when like everybody was freaked out that it was going to keep going, without telling her why, because she was in a nursing home where they're not allowed news. You know, and she just screamed and cursed at me and hung up. And then next thing I knew, she was dead. So, you know, that just seemed like, whoa, I mean, a characteristic ending, if there ever was one.
Right.
Yeah. So, and my mother, you know, and I think like, how would she react if she could see me now? And this is knowing that she really would have preferred me to be a girl. She would have really preferred me to be a certain specific kind of girl, meaning like her junior.
Chaste.
Chaste. Yeah. Damn straight. Yeah. Become a nun. Yeah. I think if, you know, if I'd been a girl, she probably would have encouraged me in that direction. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure she would have liked to have grandchildren, but I don't know. She was a kind of bride of Christ. At the same time, you know, I could see that the whole concept of transitioning genders would have been science fiction, like outer space to her. She, no preparation at all. You know, I relate in the book how in the course we spoke French at home, but it became franglais, you know, kind of like Spanglish. And so there were always English words being tossed into the mix. And one day we're having this huge fight. She called me a faggot. And I was like stunned silent by this. I was, how old was I? 16, 17 years old at this point. My father overheard, took her into the bedroom, closed the door. And then she emerged like 5 minutes later, weeping and shaking and begging my forgiveness, because she had no idea what the word had meant. And to her, when my father explained it, it was like the worst thing you could possibly call anybody. You know, so right. Just imagine how she'd react to seeing me now.
You talk about the way you felt back in the 70s with imposter syndrome. And, you know, a lot of us who are writers or artists feel this way, with or without gender dysphoria. You have these great descriptions where you say, if I was in a snapshot, I was in it as the side person or the background person with someone trying to take a photo of the more well-known or slightly famous person in the foreground. And that you felt often like a B or a C or a D-list friend. And this kind of self-loathing, paranoia of not being good enough, not being able to be a part of, not being able, did that come from not being able to show your true self in a way that was because of gender dysphoria, or from all the other, both environmental and parental traumas that occurred?
All the above, being an immigrant, being working class, blah, 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 never feeling like I'd achieved proper status and the gender thing, totally, you know, even when I was not consciously aware of it, that was going on all the time in the background. And, you know, imposter syndrome, there was a piece in the New Yorker about that like a year ago. And I remember there was a barrage of letters came in after that from Black women saying, we don't feel imposter syndrome, you know, speak for yourselves. And I realized, it's not a racial matter, but it's very much a class matter, because a lot of the people, I think, in fact, the academics who were conducting the study, like one of them had come from Appalachia, and worked her way up to a PhD from, you know, a shack. So imposter syndrome has a lot to do with class. And being trans has its own imposter syndrome, which is referred to as dysphoria. You know, there's gender dysphoria, which is the larger umbrella term. Dysphoria is a thing that happens to you in a day when you suddenly look at yourself in the mirror and you think, who the fuck am I trying to kid? I'm just an old guy. You know, this kind of stuff is very destructive. And these past 2 months when I've been, you know, in the media a lot and seeing my face in all these magazines and stuff, every time that happens, I get the slapback of dysphoria. This, you know, I'm, who am I trying to kid moment? And, you know, I try to navigate it, but it's not easy. It's probably just going to keep going on. I mean, I think I look better than I did 2 years ago, but, you know, it's, I don't know. The habits of self-doubt are so ingrained in me that there's always going to be some version of it in play at all times.
Well, that brings me to mention that you graphically described your male genitalia from the perspective of a woman, which I thought was incredible, and I hadn't really seen that. And I wondered if it was a reaction to the other thing you mentioned after your first letter coming out to your friends, somebody wrote you back a critique saying, oh, I wouldn't use the word crotch, right? I wouldn't use the word crotch in this letter coming out to all our friends. But in the book, you go through some descriptions about your the genitalia you were born with and some of the issues that surrounded that and the ways in which it affected your sex life and the ways in which it hindered your sex life. And there was a discussion of a circumcision, and which reminded both Harry and I of the great short novel or novella, The Assistant, and the main character's transition to Judaism from, I forget what he was before, random Christian, in this grocery store, and him realizing that he wanted to transition to this and doing a circumcision. And that's what reminded me about in the book. Was there ever a doubt that you wanted to describe your genitalia in this book, or was it a question? Was it something you debated with yourself?
No, it came up quite naturally. You know, it's funny. I mean, that thing about that. Okay, this is a trans woman writer I know who, or don't really know very well, who lives in San Francisco. And even though we're not friends, I sent her my first letter just because I couldn't think of another trans woman to send it to at that moment. And she wrote back this thing about I wouldn't mention my crotch, you know, and I kind of laughed at that, but I did get, you know, this one right wing review I got, and where I was reintroduced to a concept I almost forgotten about, which is very popular on the right wing, which is autogynephilia, which holds that trans women are sexually aroused by the images of themselves in female clothing, hence a fetish. And so it's part of trans protocol or something to not mention genitalia or sex when delivering an account to the straight world. That's for internal purposes only, you know? I do have a tendency to situate myself outside any group, you know, so for better or worse. But that autogynephilia thing is kind of, you know, I have to admit it upset me. And it said in this review, you know, that the writer noticed that when I reprinted this thing, I used the word crotch again. I mentioned that I changed it to belly in a subsequent iteration of that letter, but I used crotch. And this writer says something about me saying the quiet part out loud. But, you know, this is, I mean, again, I mean, transitioning, it takes so many forms. I was in a local trans support group up here in Kingston, and one of the people who was in there with me began her transition with genital surgery before doing anything else. And, you know, I mean, and also for that matter, you know, I understandably, trans people do not want to talk about the intimate stuff. I don't mind, partly because I'm over the hill. You know, I'm so old. I'm not anybody's object of desire. So I can say, no, I'm not getting any surgeries, actually. I'm not getting genital surgery because I'm too old. I'm, you know, if I were 23 or 30 years younger, could be. And I'm not getting the voice surgery, which I actually had planned to get because the waiting list was so long. By the time my date was given to me, I was already recording my audiobook. So, you know, cows out of the barn, why bother? anyway, this genitalia stuff freaks everybody out. And part of the right-wing contention is that this all has to do with sex. And, you know, it doesn't. I mean, it's sex adjacent because everything in life is sex adjacent. But it's not primarily about sex.
I mean, I like everything that is purposely graphic, but that is graphic for a reason. And as you say, I also think that nobody owes an explanation of their body parts to anybody else.
Right.
You know, as I mentioned, fertility treatments, but I am someone who does like to talk about it and normalize it, but I would be loath to say that anyone else should be expected to talk about it and to explain it for other people.
Yep. Totally.
Cool. Lucy, thank you again for coming on, taking this time and talking some of this through. The assistant came up. Malamud has some of the best closing lines, which is a very unique talent.
Yeah.
In all of literature. In the assistant, the last graph is one day in April. It helps if you read the preceding book, of course. Frank went to the hospital and had himself circumcised. For a couple days, he dragged himself around with the pain between his legs. The pain enraged and inspired him. After Passover, he became a Jew. Done. The last line of I Heard Her Call My Name, which I loved, I'm a last line connoisseur, is I lay in pieces for so long, but now I have, as the mafia guys say, been made whole. And speaking of making things whole, just because this is FAQ NYC, I'm hoping in the time we have left, I know Alex wanted to talk with you about New York and the Catskills. Mm-hmm. And presenting yourself in both places and about New York and Paris.
Well, I have actually two more questions because I loved the reading about your college years. So you talk about the rhetoric, the kind of annoying and cloying rhetoric that went on the left throughout your years at Columbia. And you talk about second wave feminism and you talk about the DSA and you talk about how at the time, a lot of the language was geared towards being behaviorally prohibited and defensive. And you touch on, but you don't go into it, the ways in which that parallels the discussions today in the trans community and on the left. And if some of that dialogue there and in some of that rhetoric, you feel a similar aversion to.
Yeah, totally. And for very similar reasons. I mean, I think that those of us who are very concerned emotionally with language, writers, poets, will never get along in political circles. You know, all you have to do is read Mayakovsky's poetry after 1917. You know, it's a certain kind of self-abnegation. It insists on rigidity of language. It insists on this quixotic fight to banish ambiguity forever, to make things crystal clear so that there can be no misunderstanding, which is never going to happen. But it enforces a groupthink. It enforces, you know, the original, for me, I mean, political correctness was a term I learned in the early 70s at Columbia. And it meant, what did political correctness mean? It meant that when the guy comes up to you on campus walk and says, "All right, how do you feel about the Polisario Front?" You have the right response, you know? And you don't know, are they the spearhead of the people, or are they running dog rotors of the capitalist imperialist warmongers? You know, that's, it's like, you know, you have to like keep up with the literature and follow the dictates. And by the way, this committee came up with a new ruling yesterday, and that just feels like it goes on in the trans community, which is so academia inflected at its higher levels. And I can't spend 5 minutes in a room with that shit. You know, I use language in a different way. And, you know, also for that matter, I'm not in the middle of it, you know, because the review in the New Yorker took me to task for like not using neologisms. Well, no, I mean, I'm older and I'm of an older literary tradition, and, you know, I've deliberately chosen to use language. I mean, I love jargon when it comes from the street, but too much of trans world jargon has the stink of the seminar room about it, you know, and that I want to avoid at all costs, if only for aesthetic reasons. So I'm both, I'm not in that world of discussion where those terms are being debated, but also I know that if I were young, I would still take the same position, because I remember how I reacted to the linguistic prohibitions of my own youth. You know, I wanted to distance myself from that kind of commissar thinking.
And you yourself are an incredibly deliberate writer. This book might be short, but many books of yours are not short, and they are really purposeful. The words, the wording is purposeful. Mm-hmm. I got to be a fly on the wall. We were acquaintances when you transitioned and became friends. The more times you visited Paris, and we got to hang out more. And I remember thinking how serene you were, not realizing the inner tumult really until later. Mm-hmm. And when we were sitting at a cafe in Paris, I think in the 9th arrondissement, we were talking about language and talking about the difference of being trans in New York and Paris. What are your thoughts about your experience being trans in the different cities in which you've experienced it? I guess, namely being New York and Paris, but I'm not quite sure where else you've spent a considerable amount of time.
Yeah, those are the only two places where I've really spent significant time. I've been to LA, San Francisco, but Madrid is a great place. Actually, Spain is like one of the most trans-friendly countries in the world. And Belgium, I went on this road trip with my son. We drove from Berlin to Paris, and we stopped in Belgium for 3 days. And I hardly have any family left, you know, except for more or less distant cousins. But we went to see my oldest friend, who I've known since I was 2 and he was 4. And we had dinner with his wife and their daughter. And I started immediately with the song and dance I was giving in those days, which is, here I am, I'm a freak. You know, you've known me for 67 years, but, you know, or whatever, 65 years. And so you must think, what a clown, but here I am. And then his wife says, "Shut up, my favorite cousin is trans." And then the Belgian government gave me a medal. I'm now an officer of the Order of the Crown as of last September. And I was thinking, well, you know, my book, The Factory of Facts, was an actual bestseller there. And everybody seems to have read it, people who read books in Belgium. So it might be for that. But then I looked in and I discovered that the under prime minister, the sous-premier ministre, is a trans woman.
Oh.
So I feel very relaxed in Belgium. I do not feel relaxed in Paris.
Interesting. I mean, I remember you mentioning it. I thought it was mainly because of the language and how a lot of the older French people would just adjust to say monsieur as soon as they heard the voice.
Right. Yeah. And I got to, you know, I kind of chilled myself out by thinking, okay, so they think I'm an aging glam rocker. Fine. You know, that's their worst things. So I, you know, made my peace. But sometimes it would get to me. The last couple of times I was in Paris, I didn't get that. They seemed to avoid using a term of address. So the last time, especially when I was there in November, I do not remember it happening at all. So I don't know, maybe my looks have improved. I don't know. But Paris, I mean, French culture is very, very sexist. I haven't been to Italy yet. I'm kind of dreading Italy. Not that I've been invited, mind you. But so I say Spain. I hope I can make another trip to Australia because that's one of the most trans-friendly places on earth. You know, it's, but by and large, as I say, I mean, I haven't gone any place really scary, although I drove from my house to Cleveland and then Detroit 2.5 years ago on this reading tour I did. And I was really scared, especially being by myself, highway rest stops, that kind of stuff. But nobody gave me a second look. You know, I'm invisible. I don't always want to be invisible, but it can be awfully useful. And I was lamenting my male invisibility in the book. I hadn't realized to what extent I'm still invisible.
Lucy, thank you again. Closing thing here, relating to some extent to different forms of invisibility. You write in the book, but for listeners who haven't read it in full yet, I heard her call my name. Can you talk a bit about, as you were becoming more public with your new self and working that out, the different ways things felt in the Catskills and in New York City?
Okay, well, the thing I say in the book is that up here, I'm wary of the population, but I don't really care what I look like. You know, I kind of think of this whole town as being an extension of my bedroom. You know, I can trudge around my slippers. When I go to New York, I feel safe, but I also feel ugly. I feel like I'm being judged, you know, aesthetically by the whole population.
Oh, man, that's... I don't know if that's particular to you. I also feel pretty judged stepping outside my door. Harry, what about you? Or Harry's never cared.
That's why I have this beard.
Well, thank you so much. I still have a million other questions, but we don't have a million other hours. So yes. Thank you so much for joining
this
us.
This is great fun. Thank you so much to both of you.
FAQ NYC is recorded out of the city, a nonprofit newsroom dedicated to hard-hitting news that serves the people of New York. The pod receives support from P&T Knitwear, an independent bookstore, cafe, and event space on Manhattan's Lower East Side, with a podcast studio that can be freely reserved for community use. We're an affiliate of the Colin Powell School at CUNY City College, where co-host Dr. Christina Greer is one of the Moynihan Public Scholars inaugural fellows, and of Flaming Hydra, where Harry Siegel is part of a collective of 60 writers and artists delivering a cooperatively owned newsletter. See more and subscribe at flaminghydra.com. I'm Adam Kimera, our engineer, and today's episode was hosted by the indefatigable Alex Brooklyn and the indomitable Harry Siegel, who's also our executive producer. A special thank you to our guest, Lucy Sant. And thank you, listener, for joining us and making it this far. Be kind, be cool, and we'll be back soon with more.
I like doing Q&As. I can do them till the cows come home. At the same time, I miss the time before writers and everybody, artists, everybody on earth is expected to explain what they do. Like, you know, wall texts in galleries that are like political rhetoric that you've heard a million times. This kind of shit. You know, I like it when a work can stand by itself, but that's just me. And I think, and my theory is that, you know, it goes back to the fact that American education is completely like falling down the stairs. I mean, it wasn't very good when I was a kid, but it's gotten so much worse. And so, like, you wrap up like elementary and high school in college. And so college, it becomes like the over-explanation of the world. And it's where all this jargon comes from, too. It's all, and why people like, you know, when it started happening that there would be like panel discussions and people went to them voluntarily, I was astonished. Why would you do that? It's the kind of thing that you'd like have to be threatened to into going to when you were a student, right? And people in later life are doing this as a kind of social practice. It's perverse.